This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
People, this is Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for June 30th, 2016, episode 1463.
Good morning!
It's Thursday.
Let's kick the tires and light the fires, Big Daddy.
Your presence is required on the command deck.
Well, it's Brand Mash Thursday, everybody. So as promised, here is our informative assemblage of interviews on fires and fire safety, lovingly collected from the Hit 'em audio vaults.
You know, when we talked, Jennifer and Jamie and I talked a week ago about the number of fires that have been happening all over the country. It just seems to be an excessive amount this year. And number of horses dying in fires. And so we thought we would talk a little bit about fire prevention today. And to give you a couple examples, on March 5th in Perryville, Kentucky, a barn fire destroyed a horse barn, killing more than 20 horses. The entire tin roof of the structure collapsed. The more than 30 firefighters on the scene were able to stop the flames from spreading to a large propane tank and a nearby barn. But the nearly two dozen horses inside the barn were killed. April 6, 2011, in Coleraine Township in Ohio, 23 horses died in the barn fire. The fire tore through the barn at Oasis Farm, destroying the 30,000-square-foot facility that was home to about three dozen horses. Officials said the fire was started by an electrical heater used to keep newborn calves warm. On April 6th in Michigan, it took nine fire departments to fight the flames that consumed a pole barn and ultimately took the life of a Livingston County man early Wednesday morning. Police haven't released much because it's still an ongoing investigation, but a neighbor that they talked to said close friends said that they were told that there was a fire that was, it was kind of electrical in nature, that wiring caused it, but there was a man that died in that fire who had an apartment in that barn. These and about a dozen other stories that I was able to pull up over the last month have happened across the United States, and we just thought it was very important that we talk to somebody about how you can prevent fires in your barn and help protect and save the lives of your horses. So we have Bill, and I'm hoping I'm not butchering his last name, Epic, who is with protectowire.com, and he's with us today to talk about prevention and what you can do in your barns. Good morning, Bill.
Glenn, good morning. Jamie, good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you. Calling you today here from America's hometown, Plymouth, Massachusetts. And I'd like to give you an overview or whatever questions you might have, because this is becoming obviously quite a concern, not only across the country, but in Canada and in many places around the world.
Well, I have to tell you first, before we get into that, we used to live in Plymouth, and there's, you know, besides being absolutely beautiful and having some great restaurants down on the waterfront there, Plymouth, speaking of fire, does the coolest 4th of July parade ever. They must have 1,000 fire trucks in their 4th of July parade. Everyone, it seemed like every fire truck from the state was there, and they're all playing their sirens. So you hear like 100 sirens going during this parade. It's so cool.
Well, that's good, too. And if you might remember the big fireworks display that's right out in our harbor here. Beautiful sight.
Yep, it definitely is. Well, tell us, you know, what are the most common things that start fires in barns?
Well, there are a number of things, Glenn. But first, you know, I think it's important to look at the fact that, yet, you know, some of these statistics you gave are quite alarming. Yet in the mindset of the owners of all of these structures, they just, you know, they couldn't believe what happened to them. So So any means of fire detection and prevention is often overlooked, unfortunately, and they leave fire prevention entirely by chance. However, the fact remains, as you alluded to, that annually there are more than 1,200 barn fires across the country each year, and most of them preventable. They get, we're talking probably in the area of $33, $34 million a year in property damage. You know, that's some pretty serious statistics when you think about it. And yet, only a few states right now, mainly Pennsylvania and New Jersey that we're aware of, have mandated fire codes for their agricultural community or barn structures. And unfortunately, fire protection still remains as a necessary evil to too many owners of barns who think that, you know, well, it can't happen to me. However, you know, that's not a good thing to rely on. Prevention and detection is what we're going to quickly overview today. And, you know, there is a distinction. Detection is a portion of prevention, and prevention itself, of course, in our experience, we've found that most of the common barn fires that start, mainly due to electrical problems, overheated, outdated equipment, wrong type of equipment using, spontaneous combustion from hay storage, and a lot of natural causes, although not too many that can be attributed to lightning strikes or anything, but careless smoking and even arson is on that list. So, you know, those are the most common.
Let's back up a little bit to the electrical, because I think you're right. I think that's where, you know, where I see in all the articles I read the most common. And Jennifer and I each owned two 100-year-old barns in our time. And I think one of the things people think about upgrading their electric in their house to, you know, to modern standards, you know, something that's earlier than the 30s, 40s, and 50s, because they're directly affected by that. They're blowing fuses all the time, and their life, you know, is affected by not having modern electric. But in the barn, because we plug so few things in, we tend to not want to upgrade our electric, yet in the barn is where the wires get chewed on the most, so you have exposed wires, and you have a better chance of having a fire in your barn from those bad electric wires or old electric. It's just so important to spend the money to upgrade your electric in the barn, put a modern panel in, and change all the wiring out, plug.
Well, that's for sure. And, you know, like you say, a lot of wiring has probably been in for years and years. And then as time goes on and there are more modern appliances available to a barn owner, such as heaters, coolers, dryers, et cetera, they just keep plugging them in without realizing the extra load that is put on that old wiring that starts causing overheats and eventually lead to fire.
Yeah, and And the other thing is it is a little bit cheaper, actually, to replace the wiring in your barn because it tends to be exposed. It's out in the open. They don't have to rip through walls and, you know, tear down drywall and all that stuff to get to the wiring. So it does tend to be a little bit less expensive to replace the wiring in your barn than in your house.
Well, that's true. And, you know, in this day and age, with fire codes being developed more and more, not only in the residential but in the commercial and agricultural sector, fire codes are getting a lot stiffer, you know, that a lot of open exposed wiring that we all may have been used to is now required to be in conduit and stuff like that. But, you know, in terms of fire detection for barn applications, a lot of the commercial codes that would seem applicable to commercial installations wouldn't be applicable to a barn installation. You know, the design criteria that people have to look at because the construction is different. The environment is a lot harsher in a barn with all the dust, dirt, chemical presence, and urine droppings and vibrations from equipment. They're just not the same type of situations that would be involved in a commercial or a residential application that is often overlooked, you know?
Right. Well, and, you know, people tend to have, I mean, we've all been lectured at so long now that we tend to have smoke detectors and things like that in our houses, and I wonder how many people actually have anything like that in their barns.
Yeah, well, it's coming about, though. You know, until until fire detection gets mandated by state codes, it's probably still going to continue, unfortunately. But, you know, that's why we got into the market. Not specifically this market, our involvement in detections such as this, and we would classify this as special hazards. In most of our lives, that is, the company Protectoir has been involved for over 75 years in industrial applications. So if you are used to living around cable trays, conveyors, dust collectors, cooling towers, pipelines, bridges, special hazards like that where normal type of detection would be unsuitable, that's where linear detection steps in and takes over. So, you know, we thought, like we did about 8 or 10 years ago, looked at quick example, covered bridges around the country. You know, they're antiques, a lot of counties have them. They were subject to arson and fire, and we went on a major program to provide covered bridge detection, which worked out good. And we think that barn fire protection is the next thing that should be considered, especially with the statistics that are alarming across the country. So while we're not saying that linear detection is the only solution.
Now, you'll have to explain that. You're talking a little bit over our heads.
Okay.
What's linear detection?
Let me give you a brief overview. Linear detection is a technology that the company developed back in 1938, just before the World War II started. And essentially, to make it simple, is two small conductors with a proprietary heat-sensitive material around each conductor. Okay, now that's enclosed in an outer jacket, so the whole outside diameter is approximately an eighth of an inch. So if you could picture this cable now that has a heat-sensitive material between two conductors, a length of this wire is strung out up to 5,000 feet. Anywhere along the length of that wire, if the ambient temperature rises to the melting temperature of the heat-sensitive material, it will melt, and the two conductors come together just like a closed switch, which becomes your alarm point. And you can accurately measure the distance to that overheat. So in its simplest form, it's a continuous length of fire detection. Well, how is it used? Well, in areas where there's a lot of concealment, for instance, in a barn where there's hay storage, we can string it through the stack of bales around on the floor area, around stalls, around the bottom underneath the hay where there might be any overheat or anything develop. But mainly in hay bale storage, but more importantly, along electrical lines, so that anywhere you get an increase in heat, a slow developing heat, which will occur, of course, before any ignition occurs, which will eventually lead to smoke. So it's an early warning device, and the early warning device is what we're concerned with because it's able to alarm and notify that there's something developing before it reaches to the stages of ignition or an overheat. Now, coupled with that in a barn application, we would, of course, expect other types of detection because if you've got large spaces to overheat, by the time, for instance, if the detector was up on the overhead, it would take a long time for any heat to be developed to get up to there. So additional devices such as smoke detectors would be used in their specific areas. You know, a smoke detector in a barn area isn't going to be too useful because of the dust and the contamination. But in kitchen areas, tack rooms, stuff like that, storage areas where there might be fast combustibles like paper and stuff, you'd want to use a smoke detector. Steps beyond that, well, we've installed flame detectors in barns so that, you know, once you see a flame detector or a radiation detector works on the basis of being able to detect visible light so that the instant a flame does occur as a result of ignition, you can get an alarm. And they work, in terms of milliseconds, to give you an idea of how fast a flame detector would work. But, of course, they're quite an expensive proposition to put in. Smoke detection has seen a lot of advancements over the year now to the point where there are what's known as aspirated smoke detectors, which is a device that continuously monitors the ambient air by having a pump that sucks air that's in the ambient air throughout the barn area into a chamber that will alert even with the smallest particle of gases or smoke. So, you know, with a combination of in a whole barn area with linear detection in areas that are concealed where heat will develop before it turns to a ignition point, coupled with smoke detectors and flame detectors, you know, you could get into some pretty big money. But on the other hand, as a minimum, with a linear detector strung throughout barn areas that are suspected, where you have a suspect of overheat, you know, at least you've got an alarm that will notify. So detection to draw the line, detection isn't the overall solution. It has to be coupled with prevention so that you wouldn't hopefully ever get to the detection stage, you know.
Right, and Bill, I got to ask you, if I was to walk into my barn right now, because I think we're getting a little deep, if I was to walk into my barn right now, what are some of the things I should be able to see and go address at that moment? What are some of the most common things you see in fire safety prevention?
Oh, a clean barn, obviously, first of all. You know, you want to make sure that there's no oily rags or trash being packed up and no loose hay. And, you know, hay storage is another thing. Hopefully you don't want to store any hay at the stall level. You want to get it at least up in the overhead above the stall area, because in the event there is an overheat of fire, you know, fire and flame is going to burn upward, and at least you'll have a chance to evacuate horses and stuff. So then, you know, proper hay storage is a very important thing to consider.
I have to say, a lot of people recommend that you do not store your hay in the same barn where the horses are. That's probably a darn good recommendation. However, you know, having owned a couple big barns, I only had one barn. It would have been very expensive to have to store our hay someplace else, because we'd have had to have a second barn built or a shed. But yet, the hay is hugely flammable.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, there are most normal recommendations you'd find if you have the opportunity to have a second barn, would have it at least 100 feet away. Because in the event of a fire, you know, the radiation from a flaming barn like that, which takes, you know, 3 to 5 seconds to reach its maximum burning rate, radiates an awful lot of heat that could affect nearby buildings. So obviously the second barn approach would be good, but a lot of folks don't have that, and they couldn't afford it. But as a minimum, if you do have storage within a barn, hopefully it could be done overhead at least. As I mentioned earlier, Jamie, to be able to string, as you stack hay, to be able to string linear detection through it, then, you know, at least when it gets to that point, hopefully that you don't have any wet hay in there that's going to lead to any spontaneous combustion, you could detect when that hay pile is starting to overheat.
Right, right. No, that's definitely a great thing. And I guess, what's the website that they could find out more about that linear wire?
Okay, as far as the linear wire, you can find it on www.protectowire, that's one word, protectowire.com. Now, let me also add that another very, very good source of barn fire information that covers a lot more detail than we're able to discuss here can be found on the website firesafetyinbarns. It's one word, firesafetyinbarns. It's a wonderful website that gives an insight to all aspects of good housekeeping, good horse care in a barn, and evacuation principles, building escape routes, and it's just a wonderful website. But
perfect.
The linear detection that I mentioned is, you know, that coupled with a combination of other things is really something it's worth a thought, because, you know, unfortunately we don't like to hear "it won't happen to me" because You know, we know it does happen. And, you know, we like right. to always say that, you know, life didn't begin as an accident, so don't let it end up as one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. It is protectowire.com for that kind of the wire, the linear wire, and then firesafetyandbarns.com. You can go through that and kind of see where you're making your mistake. So we do appreciate you joining us so much today, and thank you so much, Bill Epic. With
Jen here, host of the Horse Tip Daily Show on the Horse Radio Network. The way consumers interact with the brands they have trusted for years and those they are about to fall in love with for the first time is becoming more and more mobile, literally, and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. Podcasts or internet radio shows like this one combine the new consumer preference for on-demand information and entertainment with the power of niche market audiences. Advertising on the Horse Radio Network podcasts allows you to reach the equestrian consumer using today's preferred on-demand delivery system. It's cost-effective and flexible, able to reinforce your existing marketing and social media strategies. To learn more about advertising on this show or any of the shows on the Horse Radio Network, contact us at 859-951-2022 or you can email us at glenn@horseradionetwork.com. That's Glenn with two N's at horseradionetwork.com. Come and join the Horse Radio Network family. You'll enjoy the ride.
So this is the weekly Horse Health Report from thehorse.com, and we have Christy on with us. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning. How are you doing, Glenn?
I am doing fine. So I have to ask you before we get into talking about fires and things that so I planned this vacation and we're going away next month and we're going to go over to the Smoky Mountains and I'm going zip lining for the first time and I'm so excited about it. And then I got to thinking about you going, you probably zip lining wouldn't do much for you having jumped out of an airplane 8,000 times. Zip lining just wouldn't do much for you, would it?
You know, I've never tried, so I guess I wouldn't know. Maybe yeah, I'll have like to.
It's so controlled, and you know,
I did kind of have that impression when I went parasailing. I will admit.
Okay, hold on. So parasailing was not thrilling and exciting to you?
Well, it's just a ride, you know. You go up. I mean, the view is great. It's a nice thing to do to see the coastline. I was in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina when I tried that, and yeah, it was cool. But
okay.
I didn't do anything with it. You know, I can't fly the parachute.
I thought I was going to die when I was parasailing, and I was terrified. I'm over the water. I hate the ocean anyway. I just like to stand on the beach. I didn't want nothing to do with it, and I was forced into it, and I thought parasailing, I'm like, this rope is going to snap. It's going to take me away into outer space, and then I'm going to drop down in the middle of the ocean and get eaten by sharks. Sharks, people. So there you go. I think zip lining was...
We got sharks in outer space all in the same sentence. That's awesome.
You're our hero, Christy. You are our hero.
I don't know. I think Jamie's my hero. She's got sharks in outer space.
They're from outer space, okay? I mean, duh.
All right, thanks. Christy, what are we talking about today?
Okay, so we talked a little bit about barn fires a couple of months ago, and I actually wanted to touch on it again because the conditions right now in so many parts of the country, it's super dry, it's super hot, there's wildfires, there's barn fires that are happening because it's so stinking hot. There was a fire actually not too far away from me. I'm in the Houston area. Yesterday morning, it killed 14 Arabian, apparently really nice Arabian horses at a stable called Goslin Nix, and really hated to hear about that, of course. So I wanted to touch on it again because we want to touch on some different things. We talked to Aaron about barn fires last time, and now we have Michelle Melarano of Auburn, Maine. She's actually with Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue, and she has buku experience of dealing with all kinds of equine rescues, including barn fires. And so we've got a little bit different take on it today and some tips that I think people really might want to take advantage of in their own barns. So, Michelle, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Awesome to have you here. Tell us a little bit about just barn fires in general. They're, what, the number one local emergency affecting agricultural facilities?
They are, and they kill more horses every year than any other kind of disaster. It's important to think of them as being something that affects everyone, everywhere, at any time. Really, nobody is exempt. Regardless of economic status or, location, there's no one really is exempt from it.
And they go up really fast. I mean, they're as fast as a gas fire. They tend to be.
Yeah, they are, and sometimes even faster, because if you think of a gas fire, really just the surface of the liquid is burning, whereas in a barn, you have so much airspace, so much oxygen available for the fire to feed on, in between particles and the shavings, in between, hay, there's just so much fuel and oxygen available that it burns very quickly and very hot. And they say that you have about 30 seconds to get a horse out of a stall where a fire has originated before the horse is either consumed or to the point where it's damaged, lung tissues are damaged enough that it won't survive. And you have maybe 3 to 5 minutes to save horses that are in other stalls, depending on structure of the building, about 3 to 5 minutes to get other animals out of that building.
So the take-home from that is you want to do absolutely everything you can to avoid a barn fire. Not that that's not common sense, but you have no time unless you're already in the barn. I mean, if you're
exactly
down the road at the house, you're just about not going to get there in time.
Right, and, most of our places have constructed barns away from our houses for that reason, to make it safer for us. But it does delay our response, and it's difficult, obviously, to enter the barn when it's involved that way. Really, it's about how how the buildings are structured. We really maybe need to focus on changing the barn designs so that you have better egress for people and for animals, better suppression systems and alert systems, and easier access to the horses to get out as many as possible and, as quickly as possible.
Sure. Now, if I read some of the numbers that we were looking at last night correctly, most barn fires are very preventable, correct?
Yes. I mean, when you think about most of them are due to human error of some sort, whether that's most of them are accidental, obviously, but often due to faulty wiring, you can eliminate some of the risk there by putting all wiring in conduit, not using a large amount of extension cords. And if you have to use extension cords, use more of the industrial-sized ones as opposed to the little ones.
Yeah, you know what? I got to make a comment on that, because even at our barn where we keep our horse at the boarding stable there, when the temperature's been what they have been, around 100 degrees, you have fans on every stall, and barns aren't set up. If they were built before last 20 years, they are not set up with outlets every stall. So
right.
You have extension cords everywhere.
You do, and
I'm so glad
it's
you
pretty
went
scary.
There.
Yeah.
Well, you do, and I don't know how you avoid that unless you go to the expense of having your whole barn rewired. I mean, I don't know how you avoid that.
Yeah, it's difficult to avoid it, because you do have to, like you said, it's 100, 110 degrees. Those animals really need some way to stay more comfortable. And if a barn has not been built with that in mind to begin with, really the only way to get around it is with some of those individual fans and, like you said, a lot of extension cords. I was just at the Kentucky Horse Park for a large horse show they're having there, and they have, they have capacity for almost 2,000 horses, and every single stall had a window box fan on it, and I couldn't believe, the amount of extension cords. You can, in some cases, utilize the larger industrial fans at the ends of aisles, but it's virtually impossible in that type of a situation where, many different farms and stables are coming in and individually caring for their animals. But you could use them and better utilize them in private farms.
And what if you don't use the individual fans, and of course very important if you are going to use them to keep them clean, keep the dust out of them and whatnot. But we talked a little bit about using the bigger fans, the bigger ceiling fans, the big ass fans.
Right.
Sorry, Glenn.
No problem. But the big ass fan factory is right down from our house. it is true, and it's tough, and especially if you're boarding and you don't own the facility, then it's even tougher because you're not in charge of all that stuff. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And if you're going into a boarding facility, which is it's a great point that you bring up, that's one of the things that you can ask about. Certainly, if you're researching boarding facilities, find out what their plan is regarding fires, fire suppression, how they handle those things, if they have an evacuation plan. All of those things are very important when you're trying to choose a boarding facility. You want to make sure that they have something in place where the humans and the horses are part of their plan for evacuation in any disaster, really.
And the humans should know that plan, all the humans, not just the ones who work there.
Correct.
We have quite a laundry list of tips, and some of them cover barn design, which, of course, if you're going into a barn, as we're talking about, you can't control. But some other things, like having a posted evacuation plan that we can control a little bit as far as where we go. So can you tell us a little bit about, let's just run down that list and touch on a few of those. We don't have a ton of time, but want to make sure we touch much of them.
Well, fire extinguishers obviously are one of the most important things. And not just having them, and a lot of people have fire extinguishers, but they're tucked away in a closet somewhere where no one has seen them or knows where to find them. They need to be hanging on walls in aisles, easily accessible. You need to have overhead signs that clearly mark them, and you need to check them on a regular basis. Egress or access to the outside for humans, if you have a very long barn 30, 50 stalls, a lot of times there are just the end doors, and that's very difficult to get in and out of in an emergency. You need to have side exits as well. One key thing that does improve your chances of getting horses out safely is to have exterior doors on every stall. Now, clearly that's an added expense, but if you do have that, you have the ability to get in from the outside without entering the structure and then sort of driving the animals out and perhaps up a fire lane to a safe enclosed paddock. Too many people think that you can sort of run down the aisle and throw the doors open for the animals to run out, but the reality of that is the animal gets fed, watered, and left alone in his stall, that's his place of safety, and he's not going to leave it even when there's fire, just over his head. It's just like a kid who hides underneath his bed in an emergency or in a fire. They're scared, and that's their place of safety, and they really aren't sure what to do.
Yeah, we've read a number of reports of horses getting out, getting clear of the barn, and turning around and running right back in. So important to have
exactly.
A place where you can confine the horses away from the fire trucks, away from the barn. Hopefully, a place where they've got something to snack on to settle them down a little bit. All
exactly.
Right. So there are a number of other things on this list that I thought were really good. We touched a little bit on the doors within 30 meters of any point of the building to make it easier to get out, so you're not running down that long barn aisle.
Right.
Updated electrical wiring, using only UL-listed appliances such as your fans, minimal extension cords, caging light fixtures so that horses can't reach them, break the bulbs. Obviously, injury hazard there as well as a fire hazard. One thing that I actually hadn't heard before, which makes all kinds of sense, is having your breaker box or some sort of main power shut off near an external a way to get out of the barn so that people can shut down the power if there's an electrical fire going on. Get
exactly.
Started.
Yeah, or the fire department can, has access to that as well.
Sure.
Without having to enter the structure and hunting for it.
And this one I thought was good for, with the risk that we've got wildfires right now, especially down in Texas where it's dry as a bone, the recommendation is a 33-meter called defensible space around the barn.
Right. So you won't. You don't want your tractors parked alongside the barn. You know, those are just additional things that can catch fire and increase the size of the fire. Too often you'll see horse trailers and trucks parked alongside, or hay stacked nearby. You know, all kinds of additional things that just can get involved in that fire and increase it to the point of no return, really.
Sure.
You know, talk about some of the things that you can do prior to. If you're building a new place, one of the most important things is to include sprinkler systems, and, you know, or some other sort of fire suppression or detections. We have smoke alarms in our houses, but those really aren't good enough in barns. They get really rendered useless with all of the particulate matter. There's so much dust, and too often they start beeping, and we just take the battery out because they're not working anymore. It's too dusty. You really need some sort of a main wired system, or the rate of rise detectors that tell you about heat and other types of detectors that are more specific than just the smoke detectors.
Right, and those smoke detectors are not even always effective in repoed houses. I'm just saying, where everything's been really dirty.
Exactly. Right.
Not from experience or anything.
No, that's true.
Okay, we talked a little bit last time as well about having halters and leads at each stall, but you and I talked a little bit about the materials of the halters and leads as well, that
yes.
Nylon can be a problem.
The nylon will melt very quickly, and it can, if it hasn't melted already while it's hanging on the door, it can melt on once you have it on the horse's head. The leather will be a bit better choice. Obviously, a bit more expensive, but in some cases, it's you'll have better luck with those. And lead lines, of course, as well. You know, the cotton ones are, depending on or leather. The leather is just going to be a better choice. It's going to hold up better. Of course, if it's that hot, you're probably not going to be able to put your hands on any of it.
Sure. Now, in the situation where you do have a barn pressure saying everything's gotten very hot, one thing I was reading in Rebecca's report yesterday is that to hose the horses down immediately, which may seem like, you want to put the horse out in the pasture and go get other horses if you can, if you've even got any time. But there's a case report, I believe, of some horses that had some burning embers that had fallen on them, and it sounded like they must have had big woolly winter coats, because they didn't even realize that the horses still had embers burning their skin in their coats.
Right.
They didn't see them, and they ended up with some really bad burns from that. So
that was
another tip that I got out of that report that I thought was really valuable, to immediately hose the horses from nose to tail and, of course, get the vet out. That's obvious.
Yeah, exactly. And even if everybody looks okay, you really don't know what kind of internal damage they have from, inhaling not just smoke, but the other chemicals that are very toxic. So you really need some, immediate assessment of the animals, getting the vet out. Even in a small fire, if you think you've contained it, and you've gotten all the horses out, a week, 10 days later, you can start seeing some health issues in your animals that you didn't previously detect if you haven't had them really well assessed by a veterinarian.
And another point is to make sure that that the fire really is out. If you've got a small one that you believe you've been able to contain, that if the water doesn't get to absolutely every part of the fire, or they can flare back up later, and that, of course, not something
correct.
I want to deal
yeah.
with either.
Especially if it's a fire that's originated in hay. Because if you put hay up that's not entirely cured, if there's a bit of moisture in there that is causing it to go bad, once you could have several areas of a hay pile that's been stacked in a barn or wherever your storage area is, and it could be several hot spots. You could sort of manage one in a smaller manner, but then have a larger problem later on. But actually, just wanted to go back to one quick point that we haven't touched on, actually, is one thing that you can do for more on the planning end is to call your local fire department and get several of the firefighters to come out to your particular barn and do sort of a mutual education afternoon with them. Take a couple of hours have them walk through your facility and identify either some fire hazard areas, talk about proper egress, talk about property accessibility. I've seen some places that have great planning and great prevention with sprinkler systems and great evacuation plans, but then they have limited accessibility with a narrow road going to their barn or a gate that you know the fire department can't get through. So have them look at all of those things to find out how easily and effectively they can access the property. Have them look at those hazard areas, and then you take the time to educate them on horse behavior, some horse handling, how they can help you if there's an event on your property, how they can help you with the animals, making sure that everybody's working in the same, with the same goal in mind. That'll make it much easier for them to respond to an incident at your facility. They'll be much more familiar with your property and your buildings and where things are. If they know the hay is in one barn and they know that's just the hay barn, but the horses are in a barn right next to it, they can concentrate on keeping the animals safe or helping with the evacuation of the animals and fighting, the hay, not worrying about burning the burning hay, but worrying about burning animals. They'll be much more familiar and have a much better response and evacuation plans with you. That mutual education is very important.
Right. It never hurts to make friends with the fire department, ever, especially if you're in a rural area.
Right.
I think so. Well, we've got another little bit of information that Glenn, I will post here on the Facebook page in a moment.
Okay.
Rebecca Jimenez, you may remember she was going to be on the show a little while ago. We had a little scheduling issue, but she sent us a video called What It's Like Inside a Barn Fire, and I think that's something that everybody really needs to see. I'll post that up there in just a few minutes.
Okay. But
I know we need to wrap up here. But,
well, and I was going to say, we've talked about barn fires a couple of times in prevention, but I have to congratulate you both. I think this is the best discussion we've had yet.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
Yay.
I really do.
I appreciate that.
Well, yeah.
It's so important.
Not only can she skydive, and is she a daredevil, she's pretty good at this radio hosting thing, too.
I'm trying to learn from the best.
Why are you on
Where
our
are
show?
They?
Yeah.
Who's that? Come on.
We can recommend somebody else if you're really good.
Yeah. Give them. Can we get their number so we can talk to them too?
You guys are awesome.
Being on. Yeah,
and Michelle, is there a website for you? I know you're with the Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue Assistant Instructor, but is there a website for you or not?
Actually, you can access me through the TLAER.org website.
Okay.
That is the Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue site, and there's an amazing amount of information there, including a large section on fire incidents.
Okay, cool. And, of course, thehorse.com.
Please. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Christy. Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks for
you
having
too.
Me. Bye-bye.
So that was actually the best fire talk I think we've had. I think that there was some really good information in there.
Thank God that they can make this show real, because I sit here and talk about sharks and outer space and flying away and the parasailing, and they just skip right over me and get serious and provide information. I'm so glad that that's why we book guests like thehorse.com, because they actually bring real information to our listening audience, and we do appreciate it. So.
Hello, Robin Donahue here, and I'm an official HRN auditor. I love the programming that the Horse Radio Network offers and have chosen to support them through a monthly contribution. If you enjoy listening to any of the Horse Radio Network shows, won't you join us as a member of the HRN auditor family? You can do it for as little as $1 a month. Just go to horseradionetwork.com and click on the HRN auditor banner. And don't forget, as an auditor, we get the blooper reel.
Good morning, Eric Thompson. Eric Thompson lives in Kansas, which is way above the aforementioned freeze line that I was talking about. Last time I actually saw
not
Eric,
far enough south.
Years ago. It's not far enough south. Last time I saw him was up in Kansas, and we were attending a conference together. And I said, "Hey, I'd really like to go to Starbucks." And he cranked his truck. It had one of those cool little heater things on it that keeps his truck warm, so it'll actually crank. And he drove me down to Starbucks, and I had to go, Glenn, it was about 40 feet from the truck door to the Starbucks door, and I almost froze to death.
You know, that's when you know you are a hardcore Starbucks follower, when you walk in minus 14 degree wind chills to go get a cup of coffee. You know, we try to keep things interesting in the Kansas City area.
Eric has been doing large animal rescue since long before it was cool. And I'm going to let you tell a little bit more about yourself. But currently, he also runs the Kansas EERU, which is the Emergency Response for Situations for all kinds of livestock and horses, whether they're stuck in mud and ice or disasters that are local. They also get called out to national disasters to assist with those kind of things. So I never know where this man is. He is all over the country. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Eric?
Well, yes, and I am running amok across the country this week, and my primary job is Director of Disaster Response for Code 3 Associates, which is the national animal response team. And then in Kansas City, back in 2004, I started the Emergency Equine Response Unit, everybody knows as EERU, and it's based to serve most of the local Kansas City area, Kansas, Missouri, but we do training, awareness level training, and light operations all over the country in support of folks then going on to more technical trainings like yours, Rebecca. We started back in 2004 after a series of incidents when I was a police officer where we had overturned trailers or we had cows stuck in the mud or horses in distress. And at that time, we had no knowledge and technology in my area. And I sought out classes with Rebecca and a friendship was formed and education was shared. And oh my God, it's been almost 10 years later. Where's time gone? And I'm a little grayer, wiser, and pop a few more ibuprofen after a rescue or recovery. But it's been very successful, and we are tied into a lot of the first responder system. So we can actually provide that care on scene for large animals that wasn't there 10 years ago.
How cool is that, Glenn? Do we get some cool people on here or what? And did you hear the part about being a retired police officer? You know, that whole part about guns and men. Anyway, so I get up with that.
Well, you know, and that bodes me well when I go to teach it and I tell the cops, they said, listen, you can't pit maneuver a horse. Stop chasing it down the highway with your siren on.
And I can't tell you how many times we have had news stories where that's exactly what happened. And it's not just one cruiser. There's like 10 cruisers with their lights and sirens on hoping to stop the horse.
That's right. Yeah. And someday they actually get it over. You bet. I want to see the dash cam when it actually works.
Yeah, well, there's several really funny, well, sadly funny, like ironically funny stories of that where the horse is running down the middle line and the cop is chasing him from behind and the horse keeps looking behind him like, oh my God, it's still there. It's still there. And it's like, dude, just turn your sirens off and slow down and the horse would stop. But like you said, Glenn, are you starting to see, for 6 months we've been doing this show, and are you starting to see a theme here? It's not about the horse. The horse does what the horse is going to do because it's a horse. It doesn't think about it. But it's the human response. It's the human way that we interact with them that gets us in trouble or makes us successful. And understanding those human components, just like that. I mean, I always tell people in my classes, if I find your skull 2,000 years from now, I'm going to say you were an omnivore. I'm going to say you ate meat because of your teeth. It doesn't matter if you're a vegan or a vegetarian. I'm telling you, your skull tells me that you are going to react like a predator. And that predatory instinct is what gets us in trouble when we do things like chase horses and all those things. Anyway, go ahead, Eric. Tell us a little bit about what you guys have been up to lately.
This year hasn't been too busy as last year. Last year we had a drought in Kansas and we did a lot of mud work
And with cattle trying to get out into small ponds and being stuck. This year, we've had, unfortunately, some trailer accidents that we've had to work in the Kansas City area. And then, of course, we are in a prime location for ice accidents or ice-related accidents on ponds. As we get these hard swings, we're in the 20s for highs for 2 weeks, but then we'll have several days of 60-degree weather that really makes the ice fragile and thin in spots. And inevitably, every year, we are called out to either help with a rescue or recovery, unfortunately, of an accident where a horse has gone through the ice or a large animal has gone through the ice. And here recently, the latest accident involved 3 yearlings in the Kansas City metro area, and they had gotten out on the ice, and the owner had actually been breaking ice on the pond. The ice was probably 4 inches thick in some places, but unfortunately, when you put almost a ton of weight in one area, the ice moves and it creaks, and the construction of ice becomes weak, and it only takes a small fraction of the ice for just a few seconds for that ice to break up, and it becomes a dangerous situation. And the pond was 30 feet deep, so there wasn't an option of standing once the horses went through. So we were called to assist with the recovery, which we do to help bring closure to the horse owners, because obviously this is never an intention, and everybody doesn't always foresee the possible accidents, but we try to bring closure so there's proper burial of the animal, and they don't have to wait till spring thaw for an unfortunate viewing of the bodies as they decayed over the winter.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and this is something that Eric brought to my attention last week when this occurred, and I actually was so upset about it, I did a blog, because it's so frustrating. You know it's got to be horrifying to the owners, and of course, once I put that blog up, there's been lots of comments from people who say, you know, it happened to me, it's happened to my neighbors. Obviously, this is something that happens quite often, and it's very unfortunate. And the frustrating part is, as Eric mentioned, is it's so preventable. Putting a fence around your ponds prevents them from going in the mud. It prevents them from going in the ice. If you just have to water your animals in a pond, surely you can fence off a small section that they can get to, and then they don't take the chance of going out on the ice. So it keeps our rescuers safe too, because they don't have to go out on the ice to try to catch or get the animal that dogs are famous for it, trying to get the animals out of the situation. Have you guys had to do a lot of dog rescues, Eric?
No, not too bad. You know, we've had a great response and a great partnership with our first responders, where we do a lot of ice education for both small and large animals. And in that case, everybody in our area has done real well preparing on how to deal with small animal incidents. Unfortunately, when the small animal incidents seem to bring on more of the human aspect, because the owner will risk their lives to go out and try to save their pets. And we find that a lot of times the human rescue then prompts the animal rescue as they go out. But we see it every once in a while. You know, luckily enough, we're not dealing with large amounts of weight there. It only lasts for maybe 2 weeks when we've got really thin ice, when it's only 1 or 2 inches. But right now we're in season where it's about 4 inches thick, and the small animals haven't been a factor right now.
Tell us a little bit about the training that you do. I know, Glenn, you need to know that Eric provides the only course that I know of specifically dealing with large animals and surface ice rescue situations.
Yeah, I developed a large animal ice rescue class about 3 years ago after we had just multiple incidents, unfortunately, with a boarding stable that was poorly run. It is now closed, but we would literally be called out 4 or 5 times a season because horses had gone through the ice. And unfortunately, accidents had occurred in the recovery or in the rescues when first responders went, and they were having a hard time working on the ice sheet, trying to contain the animal in one space so straps could be run. And everything that we taught them on land-based rescues was not applicable when the animal's thrashing around the ice and trying to keep them safe on the ice sheet. Because even in proper rescue gear, if you've got proper dry suits on and proper flotation devices on and helmets, it only takes one front strike of that horse trying to get out on its own that catches a life preserver or a life vest, and it drags the rescue underneath. So we've had to develop safety systems, use of boogie boards, safety lines that are tethered 90 degrees away from the animal instead of in front of the animal. We've had to come up with ways to protect the animal from ice chips as we cut and saw through the ice and trying to keep them calm. The training came. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you, so how do you get them out? You got a horse stuck in the middle. They're never at the edge. So you got a horse stuck, you know, somewhere, you know, deep into the pond. How do you get them out?
Ideally, we take two chainsaws and we cut a path out for them. Speak on, brother. Speak on. You know, we try to go, you know, let's work smarter, not harder. And these guys the perception was at first, don't use a saw. It's too loud. It's going to scare the animal. And they would start to hack at it with an axe, which it's an impossibility, and it's not efficient. And it causes a lot of ice chips. It takes a long time. It's just as scary to the animal to see an axe being swung by its head.
Yeah, right.
So we can use part of the glide, the slip sheet, to provide a flexible barrier around the horse. We bring in two chainsaws, and we chainsaw as fast as we can to shore about 4 feet wide, or 3 feet wide, and we'll slide the ice sheets underneath the portions that we're walking on or cutting around, and then lead the animal out. And then all we have to do is make sure we're stabilizing that animal for the few minutes that we're cutting. We're not having to run straps. We're able to hopefully, and this is the only time that I've ever told a first responder, if you can throw a lead rope around his neck, go ahead, but don't pull on it. Just hold him to the ice sheet so he's not swimming away from you.
Yep.
And hopefully we can then get an emergency halter on to lead him out. And that has been our most successful option, is just to stabilize the animal in the ice until we can get the ice sheet cut. On the rare occasion that we've had to do an actual lift out, if the horse is swimming, it becomes very difficult, and you have to hold the animal to one side of the ice sheet, and you have to float your straps underneath it. We have found that side pulls out of the ice have been much more successful, because we're able to put the slip sheet of the glide in to provide edge protection. And when you're pulling to the side, you obviously have more mass to hit that glide, and it disperses the pressure along the animal, and it doesn't create such a friction point. Whereas if you try to
pull the first out of the ice, oh my God, we're talking about surface area and physics again, Glenn.
I know.
Oh my God.
I know. I should have paid attention in school.
It was never so much fun in high school. If they would have just talked about ice rescue and physics, it would have been a lot more fun.
Absolutely. Because a forward assist just creates too much pressure even though that's the natural tendency of the horse, if they're trying to come out of the ice, I really don't want their help at that point in time. They just need to relax.
All they're going to do is break through again. I mean, that's all they're going to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So the logistics of doing the haul and having enough space then for your teams to haul out becomes another issue. If you've got a short pond, you have to do a lot of change of direction with your ropes, because once you start hauling, you got to haul the full length of that ice, and then you have to haul up on shore. We don't stop hauling until we're in a contained space, and a contained space may be portable fencing, it may be livestock panels, it may be people creating a barrier, but we don't want that horse to get back up and panic and go right back out on the ice and in the hole again. We developed these techniques. We actually work with some of our fire teams that are heavy rescue guys, and God bless them, you know, they loan me their dynamometer, and we start putting pressures on these rigs to make sure we're within safety zones. And we like to see what the pressures are when we hit that critical angle at the ice sheet, when we're putting the most pressure on that horse, because we obviously don't want to cause injury. So we've put a lot of thought and a lot of testing into some of these techniques. And then we focus back to the rescuers, because the ice sheets are compromised. They are sinking and moving as soon as they get on them, and they're out there with chainsaws, and it works as a buddy system. And so we spend about 8 hours in that training. Only two or three of it is in the classroom. The rest of it is, I want them out there in the cold, the ice, and trying to work a rope on a potentially struggling animal that does not know that they're there to help. They're the big, scary yellow things. And these guys sometimes are inhibited because they may be in a rescue suit, like a Mustang suit or a Stearns eye suit, which are outstanding rescue suits for humans if you're doing bulk movements where you maybe just be throwing a ring or grabbing hold of somebody, but it limits your manual dexterity and your ability to tie knots or to do a emergency halter because it has sewn-in gloves that are not a universal fit. If you have small hands, you are basically, we call it a Gumby suit because you are making large Gumby-type movements. And we have found with some of those rescuers that they will go buy dry suits just specifically for animal rescues in the ice because there is some rigging that needs to be done on the animal. So we have found it to be beneficial.
I got to tell you, you guys have to have better chainsaws than we have, you know, to cut our trees, because I can't keep them running for 10 minutes to cut trees down. And you're cutting ice with all that water and everything. Mine would never work.
We do have heavy duty chainsaws, but they are the same chainsaws as the tree cutters. We've got heavy duty chains on them. And it's just one of those things that if it doesn't run, you're going to have to come up with plan B very quickly. And it is hard on the chainsaws. We've got two chainsaws that are designated for ice.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But you do.
So Glenn, you have not asked the obvious question, since I live not far enough south, but further south than Kansas. Has Rebecca ever actually been in the ice? No. And I have avoided it as long as I have known Eric. He has been trying to get me to come to his class, and actually, after this incident occurred last week, I told him that next year what I would like to do is get all of my assistant instructors together at his class in June or July and practice ice rescue. He said, no, you can't do that. We're going to have to do it in January or February. And I said, but it's cold. And he said, it's ice rescue. So we are actually planning on doing that, and we're probably going to have a special class just for people who have had operations level TLAR training and or are assistant instructors with me sometime next year with Eric, because I'm so impressed what he's doing. And the next time I update my TLAR textbook, I'm going to be having Eric write a chapter in it about ice rescue, which he doesn't know until I just told him just now.
Okay. Well, and she has no excuse for not getting in the ice, because I have a dry suit that she will be able to fit into, and I have a helmet, and so, you know, there's no...
Oh, wait a minute, what was that about? She'll be able to fit into? What are you saying? Is that
well,
a
you're
no.
Let's just say you're the tallest co-host I have. We'll just put it that way.
That's a good way to put that, Glenn. So
y'all are smart about how to handle women.
Well, you are. I mean, that is a fact. You are the tallest one. All my other co-hosts are like 5'2", and then you show up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Eric, is there a website for you guys?
There is. You can see our training. You can go to emergencyequinereresponseunit.org, and the classes are listed there. You can also see what's happening with the team. We try to update that as we go out and as we do trainings. EERU also advertises their training on the Code 3 websites, and you can see that at code3associates.org. And just go under the training tab, and our technical large animal training is listed also on their site.
Perfect.
And right now, I don't have any ice schedule or ice classes scheduled. Usually here in the Kansas City area, we will schedule them for February, and that way we're through the holidays, and we're out of the bitter cold temperatures. January, when it gets to be 14 below, it's not fair to keep people out there 6 hours on the ice. So by the time February comes around, we're at least in the high 20s, low 30s to go play on the ice, and that's pretty comfortable.
Oh, my God, I'm going to die.
You know what? It's okay. They'll build a campfire for you right out there on the ice. It'll be fine.
Yeah, a campfire on the ice, that sounds
good. That's
really
great. Yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah,
it'll be good.
Eric, I really appreciate you coming on the show this morning. I appreciate your expertise, and I think as a horse community, all of us appreciate what you're trying to do with your community. I know that some of your jobs doing the recoveries for animals that have gone through the ice are awful, but I think that is a huge service to your community, and obviously we greatly appreciate it and want to thank you for all the things that you do within your community and your leadership in the TLAR world. So thank you for coming on the show this morning.
Thanks for listening, everyone. For links to today's guests, topics, or products, go to horsesinthemorning.com. We'll be back live tomorrow morning promptly at 9 a.m. Eastern with another whirlwind tour of the horse world.